What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
This is Pop Culture Confidential, and I'm Christina Yerling Biru. Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me. Four-time Grammy winner, Alabama native, and acclaimed singer-songwriter Jason Isbell is having quite a year. This summer, he released the album Weather Vanes with the 400 Unit Group. He's the subject of a powerful documentary called Running With Our Eyes Closed, which follows Isbell recording his album, and with great honesty, he talks about his difficult childhood, struggles with addiction, and his creative process. He also has a role in Martin Scorsese's epic Killers of the Flower Moon. In this wide-ranging conversation, I talked to Jason Isbell about working with the likes of De Niro and Scorsese in his first major screen role as Bill Smith, being sober for a decade, and the most important things that recovery did for him. How being so personal in his songs is imperative, and about taking a stand for issues that are important to him. And how he says he feels anger towards the popular country music world for, quote, not moving as it should be, and much more. Here is my conversation with Jason Isbell. Let's get started here.
Perfect.
To quote, cover me up, we ain't leaving this Zoom.
That's good. That's the first. I've not heard that. That's good. That's
too good. Much Zoom these days.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. Congratulations. You were just nominated in three categories at the Grammys this year. You're pretty much universally praised for your performance in one of the biggest movies of the year, Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon. You feeling pretty good?
I am. Yes. And thank you. It's been a very significant year for me and for my people. So we're very happy, very grateful.
Let's start with the movie. Who is Bill Smith?
It's hard to really know. I mean, I sort of had to invent parts of Bill because there's not a whole lot of documentation. There's not really photography of Bill. You know, he wasn't the kind of person who you know, he never went on trial, or there aren't any like public documents of him. You really only know him through stories and through word of mouth. You know, David's book obviously goes into some detail, but it was kind of up to me to put a personality with him, which I think was, you know, I didn't know this going into it, but I feel like I got really lucky because you never really know if Bill is a good guy or if he's a murderer, you know. And as I went through the process of trying to do that job, I figured out, oh, this is good. This is an advantage that I have because I can play Bill the way that I know him, which is just sort of riding that line, you know.
And it's pretty much one of your first major on-screen acting gig, right?
Yeah.
And there you're thrown in with De Niro and DiCaprio right off the bat. What did De Niro sort of teach you, or what did you observe about him?
Well, it felt like playing bass in the Beatles, you know. That's what I told my wife, because it was like, you know, if you ask me to play bass in the Beatles, I will do it. And who's going to say no to that? But I'm not really a bass player. I'm a guitar player. And I can do it, but it's not going to be as good as the bass player you already have, who is Paul McCartney. So I don't know why you're asking me to do this, but I'm just going to do it. You know, that's kind of where I was. But everybody there was extremely helpful. And I think that probably comes from the fact that they're at the very top tier of what they're doing. You know, usually the people who are the best don't have a whole lot of ego issues. It's the people right under them who are the ones who are kind of assholes to you when you ask them a question. And everybody on this set.
Are you going to tell us who that was? No, I'm just kidding.
No. There were none of those. There were none of the second tier people on this movie. I mean, everybody from hair and makeup to catering to camera crew to, you know, Bob and Leo were all about as good as it gets. And I leaned on the the actresses, I hate to use that word, the female actors, I hate to use female too, the woman actors, the actors who did not identify as men on this set were very, very helpful to me. The ones that were playing the sisters, because most of my scenes were with one or more of them, and they would do things like come up, like Janae would come up to me before we would start rolling, and she would say, you know, what did we do today? And how do we know if this guy over here? When did we meet this person? When did we meet that person? I didn't know to do those things. You know, I have no acting training whatsoever. So that was very helpful. And Lily was super helpful, you know, and I realized from her that it's not exactly acting. That word doesn't mean what I thought it meant before. It's more like traveling, you know, because when it was time for Lily to be emotional, she just accessed what was already right here, you know, and which to me is got to be maddening sometimes and really difficult to do. But, you know, she just kept all that darkness really close to her. And then when she needed it, she didn't have to act. She just remembered.
Wow. And you can feel that in her performance.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah. There was no, she was not faking. She was upset, you know.
Now, correct me if this is the wrong info here. You had never seen a Scorsese movie?
No, that's not true.
I couldn't believe that because he's made a few good ones.
that's gotta be somebody else. I'm a movie nut. So, well, I'll tell you, I will tell you something though. I had never seen Raging Bull as a sober person.
Oh.
I had seen it as an active alcoholic a long time ago, but when we did the screening for the 40th anniversary or the 50th anniversary, and you know, we did Marty and De Niro did a Q&A with Leo moderating. We did it at the Bartlesville Community Center in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. It was just cast and crew. And I wore my Raging Bull Air Jordans. And the only person that noticed was the guy working the door, but at least he noticed. When we did that, and then we all watched Raging Bull together, the scene with LaMotta in jail hit me so hard because I had very similar experiences, you know, a decade ago, more than a decade ago, when I was still drinking and getting into trouble. And so the movie hit me in a really, really new way.
That's incredible. See, that's all what culture can do, how it can change your perspectives depending on where you are in your life. I love that. The Osage story, growing up as you did in Alabama, was that something you were familiar with?
No. I don't know that anybody was, you know, taught that in school. Even people I talked to in Oklahoma were like, yeah, we didn't know much about this until, you know, obviously the indigenous folks there did, but, you know, white folks in Oklahoma were like, yeah, they never taught us this. No, growing up in Alabama, that was not something that I knew anything about, you know. Really, yeah, I mean, you would think it would be something that would be taught to every kid once they got old enough to deal with the trauma of the story. But no, I didn't know.
Scorsese has said many times that cinema really saved his life. Judging by what I know from you, music has done the same for you. What did it mean for you as a kid?
Oh, you know, I was just obsessed with it. And I still am. I mean, I think any kind of creative pursuit, whether it be, you know, writing books or painting pictures or making movies or making songs, I think when you're a kid and you really get wrapped up in it, it gives you a conversation that you might not be able to find in person, you know, because I mean, Marty as a kid was asthmatic. He couldn't go outside a whole lot and be active and do things with other kids in New York. And, you know, I was a weird kid in Alabama, and I wasn't interested in doing the same things that the other little redneck kids were interested in. So, you know, it made being alone not mean the same as being lonely, you know, or being isolated, because I had a conversation, even though it was just a one-way conversation. I was listening to records and playing the guitar, you know, there was nobody on the other end of it. It was like, you know, for the longest time, it's like you're playing ping pong with the wall, you know, but by the time the wall becomes an opponent, you're a really good ping pong player. And it was like that. So when I was a kid, I was just in my room playing the guitar all the time. I mean, when I didn't have to do something else, that's what I did. And when it was time for me to use that to communicate with people, when I got a little bit older, then it became just my access to the world.
You're certainly also such a storyteller. You were mentioning before you've been so personal in terms of your depression and recovery and addictions. Has it always been easy for you to be so personal through your music?
No, it's never easy. Yes, never. It's never easy, but I don't think it's supposed to be, you know. I think if it's easy, that means you're not sharing enough, you know. I sort of have a rule where if I write something in a song and it feels like it's uncomfortable, then it's got to stay in some form or fashion. I have to make it work because that feeling of trepidation is a positive sign for me. It's like, okay, now I'm telling people something that might not paint me in the best possible light, which means that that's the thing that they're going to recognize. That's the secret that I'm going to know about them when they hear it, and that has to make it into the song. It doesn't mean that you can't keep certain changes and certain challenges private, you know. And obviously, yeah, I have a kid, so that's not the kind of thing that I'm not going to put her under the
Right.
hot lamps. But at the same time, when it comes to me trying to learn how to be the best version of myself, it all has to go in there, and it never really gets any easier. It's kind of like writing the songs. I think it's supposed to get harder as you do it more, because you're supposed to refine the way you do those things, and the way you edit, and the way you finish telling the story. You're supposed to get better at it, which means it's supposed to get more difficult, I think.
Are you afraid of once in a while of the reactions while you're waiting when you're putting out a song being so incredibly personal?
I mean, I'm aware, you know. I don't know if I'm afraid, but you know what I see, this is something that motivates me to make the song better structurally. If I'm telling people something that makes me uncomfortable, the best way to end the criticism of that is by doing it with a song that's making them cry. Nobody is going to simultaneously cry and criticize what you've said in your
That's a
song. They
weapon
can't
there.
do it. Yeah, they're too busy crying to talk shit about your song. If you write the song right, if it's done correctly, then the craft, the art of it, will overcome any sort of problem that you might have with the content getting out there. It's got to be a
It's
good
got to have a
song.
good
That's
one.
it. If it's a good song, you can put anything in it, as long as it's still a good song, you know.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Someone in the documentary, which is amazing, called Running with Our Eyes Closed, says something like there was never a day of great decisions for Jason at a certain point in your life when things were really difficult. Are your days different now?
Yeah, they're
Yeah.
very different. Yeah, my weekends are really weird, and have been for over a decade. Yeah, things are very, very different now. Most significantly, I make the decisions, you know, and I don't necessarily always make them right, but I make them. And I think that's the most important thing, because if you don't make them,
You're not letting your
then they.
addictions make the decisions for you.
Yes, or other people, or your lack of boundaries, or your lack of confidence. You know, they will make those decisions, will make themselves, and then one day you'll look up and you'll go, I don't know myself. I don't know how I wound up here. And at the very least, I can tell you how I got here now. You know, because I intentionally made these decisions before they made themselves, or before some pathology in me or somebody else made them. And I think that's really the most important thing that recovery did for me, was encourage and eventually force me to make those choices in my life. It's still tough, man. It's still there's a bunch of stuff that I have to do that I don't want to do, you know, and a lot of it's really heavy and really sad, but I go home and I go to sleep because I know that I made it in the best way that I could, you know.
I was struck by something you said in an article recently. You said, I don't need to romanticize the past because that's a shortcut. I've been thinking about that a lot. And you really don't. It seems like you tackle what's happening in the country very much in the present. If you're talking about racism or abortions or this progressive side that you're really open with, how is that taken in the country community?
You know, I don't, I'm not necessarily part of the country community. I live in Nashville and amongst the country music singers and stars and things. And yeah, there are some people who I think take issue with what I say, but you know, lucky for me, I'm a man and I'm big and I'm white. And so they don't say anything to my face. And I honestly, you know, I don't really have to pay it. Like if you can make a good argument, if you can come to me with a good argument, you know, for why that I'm wrong in believing or speaking these things, then I'll listen to you, but I've not heard it yet. I've just heard, you know, vitriol, and not even that much of that, you know, the way I see it, my maleness and my whiteness, it's sort of this armor that I was lucky enough to have. And the person who was wearing the most armor should go up in front, you know, when you're laying siege or trying to defend something, you know, I am a very protected class of person. So for me to be happy with the bounty that I have been blessed with and the really wonderful life that I have, I have to go up front every once in a while and say, hey, this is not right. This is not fair.
When are those points when you choose to use your celebrity or your platform to
anytime
possibly change?
Anytime I see something that I think I might be able to actually help. That's the question, because there's a point of diminishing returns. Like if I spend all of my time yelling about, you know, whatever, any topic, if I on social media or in person, in public, at dinner, during my shows, in my songs, then I'm going to pass the point of diminishing returns where people are going to stop paying attention to what I have to say. So first I have to entertain people and I have to move people and I have to do my job and do my work. So at shows, I'm not going to go into rants between songs most of the time, because that's not the show, is to generate the audience and to move the audience. But anytime I see something and I think I might be able to help with this, that's when I will say something. The only time I won't is if I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. Or if I don't think that it's going to make any difference for me to say anything or not. And I know there is some, you know, naivete in the idea that we ever really move the needle. But, you know, sometimes it's not about moving the needle. It's about letting people know that they're not alone in their own anger. Country music so far is so far behind, you know, and there's so many people that have done the work and have the talent and, you know, are good decision makers and good leaders and responsible. And then, you know, they're having to work real hard for very, very small rewards. And then there's people who sell, you know, I don't know what, millions, hundreds of thousands of records. Nobody really sells millions of records anymore, but there are people who are succeeding by doing the bare minimum. And, you know, it's, I think it's worse in country music than it is in other genres right now.
Because I can feel with my own kids that, I mean, the world is just in such a difficult place and it's even more divided than it feels like it was just a few years ago and where we're heading. Are you positive as can make change and that something's going to happen, or is it going to be even more divisive as we go forward to the next election, for example?
Well, I like divisive. Mm-hmm. You know, because to me, the option,
well, there's an
is,
aggressive divisive and there's,
yeah,
there's a good,
you know, people are assholes. I don't like that, but I like divisive because mm-hmm. Here's the thing. To me, the only option is we're divided or we all agree to go along with the idiots. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two options. And up until recently, a lot of us have agreed to go along with the idiots, or at the very least to ignore their idiocy. I would much rather us be divided than all of us say this is all okay and it's fine for us to keep going this way. That being said, I think we're actually at a really good, I think this is, for a lot of people, we're at a better time in history than we've ever been. Because now at least we're talking about these things and people have a platform that they haven't had in the past, you know, like if you go to audition for a movie and somebody grabs your ass, you can tell the world about this now. This is not something that you would have been able to do, you know, and it looks on the surface, the repercussions of that, the consequences of that makes it look like everybody's at each other's throats. When in reality, you just had to shut up before. You just couldn't say anything about it. So the way I see it, we're having conversations. A mistake was made a long time ago when we didn't already have these conversations. And now we're just dealing with it.
Do you see that things are changing in country music as well? I mean, can you step up as a woman? Can you?
I would love to say that's true, but this is one of the reasons why I sort of hold a lot of anger at what is a popular country music world, because I don't think it's really moving like it should be. You know, I have friends who are country singers who have left the genre because they are, you know, women, and no matter what they do, they can't, you know, get on the charts, played on the radio in the same way that men do. And also, you know, people who aren't white, it's the same deal. They just, they keep working and nothing happens. I mean, if you look at the country charts, you know, it's still very rare to see a woman in the top 10. And yeah, I don't want to say that it's a lost cause. I just think that as the genre grows, which it is very much growing in popularity right now, you know, both sides get an opportunity. The people who are trying to make progress get an opportunity, but the people who are trying to halt that progress also get an opportunity, and they get a great deal of motivation out of just the commercializing and the capitalism that's involved. They're making a whole lot of money right now putting, you know, average white dudes with guitars in front of everybody all the time, over and over and over. That is working from a business standpoint. And because the genre is expanding to be more global and more of a pop genre, that's going to give them motivation to keep doing things the same way. And I think that we've come to a point that seems to a lot of people like it might be an impasse. So I try not to focus too much on the result, and I try to just keep doing what I think should be done. Country music's a tough one. That's a tough one right now. And that's kind of like, you know, the art world. I mean, how many famous women are painters, you know? Mm-hmm. How many famous women painters are there? Like,
or directors
Yeah. You know, it's across the board, but there are a few places where it is extremely egregious. Like, if you're looking at you know, fine art, visual, like paintings and sculptures, The percentage is so incredibly low. Yeah. And it's that and country music are pretty much neck and neck for the most exclusive to white men, you know. Anyway, I don't know. I could go on about this for a long time, but there's a lot going on there. Yeah.
I was so taken by your wife, fellow musician Amanda Shire, in the documentary, and how much the strength that she has to you know, really get you through what you got through. What would you say is the best advice to someone who's close to someone with addiction problems?
I don't know if I could tell anybody that they should hold on for as long as she held on, you know? I don't know that I would advise that, because she's unique in that way. She was able to handle it and keep herself. And also, I got sober and I stayed sober, and that doesn't usually happen. Most of the time, you know, it's an albatross, and there comes a point where you have to, you know, make a decision. Am I going to continue to support this person through this, or am I going to do what's healthier for me? So I'm very grateful that she hung in there when she didn't necessarily have to, or probably shouldn't have, and I probably underestimated her own resolve and her own character. But yeah, I mean, the thing that I tell people, if somebody calls me and they say, you know, my son or my husband or my wife or my mom or somebody is, you know, just starting their recovery process and they're looking for advice, I don't have a lot of advice to give for that. But what I normally say is make them feel needed, you know, and it's going to take some risk on your part, because sometimes supporting somebody and saying, I'm here for you, no matter what, is the worst thing you can do for them. Because then they have, you know, oh, well, you're here for me no matter what, so I'm going to go get drunk, you know.
They have to do it on their own.
Yes, and also if you're looking to help them, you can, and this takes, this, there's some risk involved here because they might totally screw this up. But if you give them a responsibility, like, I need you to do this for me, you know, not get sober. I need you to pick up my mail every Thursday. I need you to take my kid or our kid to school in the mornings. There's definitely risk, but if you give them that responsibility, then they feel like, well, I'm useful. I'm tethered to the world in a way that's not just they're trying to hold me up and I'm trying to drown. You know, and I think that was something that Amanda probably did for me. Not necessarily intentionally, maybe intentionally, but early on, I felt like she needed me to be there and she needed me to be alive and she needed me to be sober. And that was very important to me, to be needed in that way.
Going back to the movie finally, what do you hope that people are going to come out of this film feeling and doing and wanting?
Well, there are two, this kind of goes back to the conversation that we were having before.
Right.
You know, I hear a lot of people who work in a creative field now who are saying, well, we can't say what we want to say anymore. We can't make the jokes that we want to make. We can't, you know, make the movie. Everything is offensive and we're not allowed to be free with our work. And then there's the side that I see when somebody like Marty does something like this. And I see it as a great, great opportunity because, you know, what I hope is that a movie done this well on this scale will inspire other people that are making movies to tell these stories that have always existed, but that I didn't hear in high school. And you know, you might not have been taught when you were growing up. Like these are incredible stories. They have all the drama that you need to make a beautiful movie or book or song or whatever you're making, and they're there and they're real and they're, you know, they really happen to so many different types of people, even just in America, if you're just working, you know, in that particular medium. I hope that people come out of this saying, oh, I want to make a movie about one of these kinds of stories, you know, because that really, I think could shift, the culture of filmmaking and just art in general, in a direction of making it widely consumed rather than just, you know, smaller, more boutique ways of telling those stories. I would love it if the biggest movies of the next 10 years were stories that we all should have heard before, whether it's about, you know, Native people or Black people or, you know, anybody who has been, you know, forced to endure some type of injustice, because there's millions of those stories to tell.
Thank you for telling those stories with your songs and for participating in a movie that tells these stories. And I hope you'll make many more. And thank you for talking to me.
Thank you. I enjoyed our conversation. It was a good one. So I appreciate your time.
I'm so happy you did. Thank you. Thank you so much to Jason Isbell. Killers of the Flower Moon is out now. The documentary, Running with Our Eyes Closed, is an HBO original, and we wish Jason the best of luck at the Grammys on February 4th. And thank you so much for listening. Subscribe and follow Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts. Pop Culture Confidential is a part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. See you next time.
You know, a lot can happen in 7 minutes, and luckily, that's how long it takes me to tell a story. My name is Aaron Califato, and I'm the creator of 7-Minute Stories. I'm proud to partner with Evergreen Podcasts, and I'd like to invite you to join me on this journey. I'm going to take you on some crazy roller coaster rides using my unique extemporaneous storytelling style, and together, we're going to try to make sense of the world, all through the art of storytelling, and all in approximately 7 minutes.